You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Satan, your kingdom must come down. Satan, your kingdom must come down. I heard the voice of Jesus say, Satan, your kingdom must come down.
Gonna pray. Hey there, everybody. This is Danny Anderson thanking you for joining me for another episode of the Sectarian Review Podcast. It's Halloween, which is, you know me, if you know me, as you might. This is, I don't know why else you'd be listening to this if you weren't, if you didn't. This is one of my favorite times of year. And so, as you know, the network for the past, gosh, 5 or 6 years has done a Halloween crossover where we pick a thematic thing to talk about having to do with something creepy, and all the shows on the network produce a podcast about it. And so this year we are doing Edgar Allan Poe as a theme. And so every show on the network, with the exception of Book of Nature, they took a hiatus for this one, is doing a different Poe short story. We are going to be talking about The Mask of the Red Death, we being Carter Stepper and I, and I'll introduce him in 1 second here. If you want to go to the other episode, the other programs on the network, though, the Christian Humanist Radio Network crossover will include City of Man covering The Telltale Heart, and the flagship, the Christian Humanist Podcast, is going to be doing Descent into the Maelstrom, and the Christian Feminist Podcast will be covering Bernice. And so it's a lot of really cool things to talk about. Poe, I have a kind of love-hate relationship with. This kind of fiction I like. Some of his detective fiction is intolerable to me. But this I enjoyed. Carter, welcome back to the show. Carter Stepper, we're going to be talking about Edgar Allan Poe. How have you been?
I've been doing well, Danny. This is one of my favorite times of year, too. And I also have a mixed relationship with Poe, but excited to be talking about this story today because this one is one of the better ones.
I really enjoyed Mask of the Red Death. It's very weird and allegorical, and it almost doesn't read as much as a story as it does a kind of like almost a Kafka-esque philosophy piece. And so
it's, or a flu dream.
Yeah. Okay. I could go with that too. Yeah. So yeah, it's a really interesting story to talk about. Before we get into it, though, I just want to kind of throw it out there as a reminder. I have gotten rid of the old website for the show, and I now have everything going through a service called Authory. And so I would love it if you would subscribe via email to my Authory page. If you just go to, it's AUTHORY. If you go to authory.com/Danny Anderson, you can find my page there. And not only all the podcasts will show up, and you will also get links to anything I happen to write wherever it happens to live on the internet. And so all of that is housed in one place, which makes my life a lot easier. And you will get just once a week in any week that I publish something, an alert saying that that happened. So it's not an overwhelming email thing, and it certainly doesn't cost anything. So, but I would love to be in contact with you. And you can email me through that page as well, which is very handy as well. So, but let's get right into business here. Carter Stepper, tell me what you thought. What are your sort of initial read, you know, feelings about reading Mask of the Red Death?
A number of things really caught my attention. The first was sort of the class divide between the main character Prospero, his name means prosperous in Italian and Spanish, which tells us that he's either Italian or Spanish, I guess. Yeah. Otherwise, we don't know where this place is. But there's definitely this sharp class divide between him and everybody else who's dying in his kingdom. But really there's this displacement sort of feeling about this whole thing, because other than his name, we don't have really any real idea where this is. It's not in any one place. You have all these different color chambers that each one is like this sharply distinct color, blue, purple, orange. But instead of being in a straight line like they normally are, they're all at weird angles, and he's having a masquerade ball is the setting for the story, with all the lords and ladies that he's locked inside this abbey castle. And all of that combined really gives this a dreamy, sort of displaced, kind of in the world but not in the world feeling. It's a very, it's surreal. And I mentioned to you before the show, it gave me David Lynch-y, Twin Peaks-y kind of vibes in a lot of ways.
I could totally feel those vibes, actually. Yeah. And surreal is a perfect way to describe it. It doesn't feel like a finished story. There's not really characters. I mean, there's Prospero as a figure, right? But he's not developed as a character, per se, right? Everybody sort of just stands in almost in a symbolic way for something else. So to me, it felt very allegorical. And the mystery is like what the allegory is about. You know, I mean, Poe dealt with sickness, you know, in both in himself and his family, you know, during his life. And so, and certainly during the mid 19th century, cholera outbreaks and tuberculosis took many lives, right? And so,
including his wife, correct?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so there's clearly, you can see inspiration there. But I think just approaching it initially is this kind of memento mori kind of thing about...
Oh, I was going to talk about that.
Oh, yeah. Good, good, good. Yeah, I think we can definitely get into that. There's a way in which this is a meditation just sort of on... I mean, this almost stands as a literary example of that artistic form of putting skulls in paintings and in architecture in churches, right? To remind us that we're going to die. This is sort of a literary version of that. And yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think this is one of the strengths of the story, and it is in some other Poe stories, but not as much. I think the displacement feeling, the feeling that it's hard to put it in a time and place. I mean, it's roughly medieval, obviously, but its allegorical or surreal sort of nature is what makes it probably one of his more effective stories for us now, because and it's a sort of, that's the point of allegory, right? Is that allegory sort of universalizes across time and space. So, I mean, I think I've got a few different thoughts on like how this story could be taken and applied to our contemporary setting and contemporary world and make sense of certain things.
Sure.
And sort of reveal certain things through the allegory. But
yeah, absolutely. And I'm, incidentally, I had it in my notes to introduce you as the High Priest of Horror, Carter Steffer.
Well, we don't have high priests, but
but Carter, you are a priest.
I am. I'm an Anglican priest. Yeah, that's correct. I have a small parish in Spokane, Washington, and
yeah.
It makes stories like these really fun too, because there's always this weird sort of spiritual edge to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to talk about that. You have not seen it, but there is a really great film adaptation of this. And I know in the network we're supposed to focus on the story and not the film adaptations, and we are certainly going to do that. But I don't know that I can talk about this without going to the 1964 Roger Corman directed, Vincent Price starring version of this movie. And it really plays up religious angles that the story might imply, but doesn't necessarily get into. And so I'll get into that later. So your priestliness will come into play maybe towards the end of the, at the end of the
High Priest of Horror. Hey, you know what? I love the title. I'm just going to go ahead and take it. Ecclesiastical rules be darned.
exactly. And so, well, let me real quickly for listeners who haven't read the story. It's very short. It's only 4 or 5 pages long. It's a very quick read. And like I said, it's not so much a plot. There's a setting, basically. There's a plague going around, the Red Death, which is not the Black Death. The Red Death is something that basically comes on you. You're afflicted and you're dead in 30 minutes from all this kind of bleeding from everywhere in your body. So blood is associated very deeply with this. And so it's ravaging the countryside, and Prince Prospero is going to basically hide out in his castle with all the other noblemen and women of his region. And they're going to sort of hold out the thing, or hold out until the thing's over. And basically it's an extensive, decadent kind of hedonistic party, that they're holding. And then the mask is sort of like a ball or a dance that they're going to be holding, to get them through the Red Death. And at some point during the, festivities, someone comes dressed as a figure shows up dressed as a victim of the Red Death. And this is intolerable to Prospero, right? He's angry that someone would kind of ruin the vibe of his party by reminding them of why they're all there, right? And so, like, there are actual people dying, and this is not something they want to kind of focus on, is how I read that, his anger towards this. And so he's going after this person and with a knife, and it turns around, you hear a scream, Prospero is dead, and then the rest of the company descend on the figure, and there is no figure there. It's just sort of an empty costume, and it turns out that this was sort of the Red Death embodied, and they all very quickly die of the Red Death. And the story, if we want to call it that, ends with the line, and now is acknowledged the presence of the Red Death. He had come like a thief in the night, and one by one dropped the revelers in the blood-bedewed halls of their revel, and died each in the despairing posture of his fall. And the life of the ebony clock went out with that of the last of the gay, and the flames of the tripods expired, and darkness and decay and the Red Death held illimitable dominion over all. Right? It's a really kind of very Poe paragraph.
That is the most metal ending of a... story.
It's very metal. Totally. And so it's got a very bleak ending, which goes into this whole memento mori thing. And so, yeah, so let's approach it. You said you wanted to talk about that. So let's kind of begin with that as a framework to view this kind of almost stoic idea that death awaits all of us. And so what do we make of that based on the story? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know this, but just for the sake of people listening, the memento mori tradition is a monastic tradition in the historic church. Memento mori just meaning remember that you will die, right? And while that sounds morbid, it's really not meant to be morbid. The whole point is that was used as a kind of like the Jesus prayer. It's used as like a focus point for meditation. You meditate on a phrase over and over again. It's similar to Lectio Divina, right? Where you read scripture, you read a line of scripture, and you just meditate and contemplate, right? The idea being that it's then supposed to become ingrained so that you then live in a way that reflects that. And the memento mori idea is, remember, you will die. So live a life worthy of God now, because you don't get a second chance, right? So few things that are really interesting about that here. First of all, this is an abbey that he made into a castle, or at least it's a castle in an abbey type style. So it's like it's set in a monastery almost, right? So I don't know if Poe did that on purpose to connect it to this, but instead of there being monks inside, reflecting on memento mori, the whole idea is that you have these people who are locked in. Like, it says that the doors are locked and you can't get in or out. And the whole point is Prospero's escaping death by leaving the rest of his people to face the Red Death alone. And he's just going to party it up. And that's with his lords and ladies. And that's really the exact opposite. That's the whole point of the memento mori, is to say, don't just don't live that way, but live in a way with holiness, etc. I mean, that's where, you know, Paul has this idea of, if Christ isn't risen, then I'm paraphrasing, but eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you'll die. The difference there is that if Christ isn't risen, then you just die and you're dead. And nothing matters. So you might as well live that way. That's how Prospero's acting.
Yeah.
There's no judgment. There's no consequences. Prospero's got money. He's got his castle. He's got his lackeys and his friends. So he's just going to live and party and do everything he can to forget that he's going to die.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is sort of like it functions exactly like those skulls that we see in religious artworks, right? In religious painting and in architecture. There are, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are, maybe I only know this and maybe it's a false memory because I know it from the show Hannibal, but there's a cathedral he visits where there's a skull carved into the floor for that purpose, right? And I don't know if that actually exists or is something they invented for the show. Well,
that may be. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, there's a church in Prague, I want to say it is, that is... I don't know if you've heard of this, but the plague went through the city this church is in once, and the church, just look up Skull Church on Google. It is literally full of human bones.
Oh, interesting.
Made into like the chandeliers, the walls, the decorations. It's all actual white human bones. They were the victims of the plague back in the Middle Ages. It is astounding and beautiful in the most macabre way possible. But all of that to say, yes, skulls feature very prominently in Christian iconography and artwork for this very reason.
Yeah.
So,
and you know, one thing I have to say, I want to get into the idea of plague. I feel like it deserves its own,
sure,
its own discussion. So let me bracket it for now. But,
yeah,
we, where I work at Mount Aloysius College in Crescent, Pennsylvania, send your kids, we're a great school. Our historic Sisters of Mercy school, and about 100 years ago there was the of course the Spanish flu epidemic, and this area, like, the no one was lost here at the school at the time, and the people saw it as a kind of miracle, which was, I mean, I'm not discounting that it was a miracle. We're also very isolated, right? And so we had that going,
sure,
for us, but to commemorate, to be an act of thankfulness, they built a grotto, like a stone, like kind of cave, with statues of Mary and whatnot out in the, in the circle, to sort of be as an act of thanks and gratitude for protecting the community during the cave or the plague. Right. And so, and I feel like in some ways it's the opposite approach to what like Prospero is taking. Like Prospero like holds himself up at the beginning, and there is no sort of like act, there's like a denial of God in his actions, right? Because he doesn't want to sort of face the judgment. And I say all of that to get to the point of what is it he's afraid of, right? And I feel like you brought it up earlier. There is definitely sort of a class issue in this story, like at least implicit in the story, because of just of the nature of who's invited to the party, who's invited to the sanctuary. It's all the wealthy, right? And the countryside.
Knights and dames of his court, he says.
Yes, the peasants in the countryside are being decimated by this. And there's no real concern for them. And so there's a way in which the class critique may be part of why he's avoiding the idea of death, because death is the great leveler between rich and poor, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I did think quite a bit about the class divide in this story. On the one hand, yes, I mean, it says the dominions were half depopulated. So, I mean, this thing has taken one out of two people. And as you said, he invites his knights and dames, locks them all in his castellated abbey. So an abbey made into a fortress of a type. It strikes me that... It strikes me that, yeah, that this is, like, as you said, death is a great leveler. He wouldn't be able to avoid it were he not wealthy and powerful. So there's this, I don't know how much of this, again, is a critique by Poe. It's always hard to tell with Poe, right? Yeah. It's hard to tell how much is critique and how much is just like, this sounds like a good story.
Yeah.
But I immediately went to thinking about how this plays out in a modern context. Again, this is allegory, so it can really apply to multiple different situations. But I was thinking about, thought about healthcare, actually. So I've got parishioners in healthcare. My wife is a nurse. Like, I know a number of people who are in the hospitals. And despite even the fact that everybody has some level of healthcare now, the fact is that more money means better care. That's just the way it is. And we talk about things like equality and people having, you know, the opportunity to have this or that and, you know, providing healthcare to everybody. But the fact is that, again, if you're a richer person, you have a better chance of survival. And I know that's maybe a stretch, but it seems like a similar thing to me here, in that with that, you get to have more decision over your fate. You get to have with more money comes greater control and greater ability to ensure your health and well-being into the future. But then what the story is doing, of course, is saying you can't forget the people beneath you. You can't forget. I mean, beneath is the wrong word, because that robs people of dignity. But you can't forget the people who have less than you in material terms. And that's really what he's doing, right? It's not just that he's wealthier and can protect himself. It's that he's doing it without, it says, any sympathy of his fellow men. The whole point is that it says in the first page, shut him out from the aid and from the sympathy of his fellow men. That was talking about the victims. It says, but Prince Prosper was happy and dauntless and sagacious, even though his domains were half depopulated. So it's not, again, it's not just that he's protecting himself. It's that he's, by doing what he's choosing to completely ignore the plight of his fellow people who he should be helping in some way. And that's the thing that I think condemns him in the end, and makes death, the Red Death comes to him with vengeance.
Yeah, it's like it seems to be sort of just an arbitrary force of nature for everybody else. For him, it's like, you deserve it, right? That's kind of
right. Exactly.
That's sort of what the story implies. And in fact, I mean, there are other lines in here. The external world could take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve or to think, right? Which is why he gets so upset that a person he thinks would come dressed as a victim of the Red Death. How dare you remind me of my responsibility to those people, right? And just implied in the economy of a prince, Prospero, who has a domain that has been depopulated. I mean, his privileged status is not only, I mean, it is also made possible on the backs of the people that are now victim to the Red Death, right? I mean, he doesn't have to do anything for his wealth, because they're all pulling in crops for him, right? And so,
right.
there are definite parallels to sort of the way in which class still works, right? And so, I mean, Poe is writing at the dawn of the industrial age. So when we're starting to kind of see the effects of, you know, industrialization on human societies, 1850 is when this story is written. And he's using feudal sorts of time periods to allegorize these kind of power distinctions, but they still exist today, right? And absolutely, healthcare is a way to think about a way in which they manifest.
It's kind of, okay, I'm going to go after a group now. and I think we're on the same page on this. It's kind of how you have, like, supposedly well-meaning liberals of the celebrity type who have these fancy dinners to support this or that cause.
Yeah.
That is, you know, granted an important cause and maybe does some kind of good, but at the end of the day, they're having a fancy dinner. And there's like this disconnect between what they're doing and what it's meant to accomplish or who it's meant to help. And it often just, like, these kinds of things just come off as condescending, right? But that's even a step better than this, because, again, this is just him saying, screw everyone else. Let's have a party.
Yes, absolutely, right? It's so weird that you mentioned that. I was just in class. I'm teaching a class on social media. We're reading a book called
Sorry.
No, it's been a great class. They're a great group, actually. And public props to Victoria Reynolds Farmer, who called into my class recently to talk to them about her work and stuff. So that was a really, really great opportunity for them to see her. But today we're talking about a book called The Twittering Machine by Richard Seymour. And he actually mentioned Mark Fisher at one point in the book. And so I was talking about Mark Fisher with them. And I was just thinking about what you're describing, how these supposed remedies for the ills of basically capitalism, right, are basically not really cures, but they're not alternatives to capitalism. They're just sort of, well, as Fisher puts it, the aim was only to ensure that some of the proceeds of a particular transaction went to good causes. The fantasy being that Western consumerism, far from being implicitly or intrinsically implicated in systemic global inequality, itself could solve them, right? And so what you're describing with these kind of charity balls and that kind of thing are basically just ways to prop up the system and to absolve it from responsibility for its own privilege in that system. And that's from Capitalist Realism by Mark Fisher.
So. It's kind of a sophisticated, I don't want to be too judgmental because, again, I realize that the intent is good, but it feels often like a more sophisticated way of accomplishing what Prospero's trying to accomplish.
Yeah, right? a
sophisticated way to expunge yourself and to not feel guilty.
Exactly, right? And that's why Prospero's response at seeing what he thinks is a person bringing the severity of the situation into the ball. I could totally see your well-meaning liberal being just as upset at people who are sort of showing them their own complicity in the system, right?
Like a homeless person was to show up at one of those balls.
Yes, absolutely, right? A dinner to for funds that would go to serve homelessness. If you had a bunch of homeless people show up, they would freak out about it, right? So yeah,
right.
I could say to paint with a broad brush, as I am wont to do.
Yes, yeah. Again, not wanting to throw everyone in with that, but it. As someone who lives in a situation where I'm actually in a poorer neighborhood, materially speaking, and these there's a big difference between seeing it from afar and seeing it up close. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, to kind of connect where we come from and where we are, the sort of kind of religious, quasi-religious allegory with Memento Mori. Mm-hmm. Is connected to this kind of class critique, I think, that is implied in this little allegory. I don't even like to call it a story because it doesn't really have a plot, right? And so, right. I mean, a couple of things happen, but there's certainly no character development. A couple of other things I want to kind of get to. One is just on a literary level, the rooms. You mentioned the way in which the rooms are designed, not only in their color scheme. So there's a pattern, the rooms progress. There's a blue room, there's a purple room, a green room, a orange room, a white room, a violet room, and then a black room that has red windows. And so in the black room, you have kind of the colors of black and red working together to make a particularly nightmarish environment, as one can imagine, right? Right.
Ozzy Osbourne's office.
Yes, exactly. And so, yeah, there's definitely that going on, right? And so now the design, so I don't, maybe I'm reaching here a little bit, but I feel like in some ways this reminds me of Shirley Jackson's Haunting of Hill House. I don't know if you've ever read that book.
I haven't. No.
It's a fantastic book. The series by Mike Flanagan is also fantastic, the Netflix series.
I'm watching that right now, but I haven't finished it yet.
It has nothing to do with the book whatsoever.
Fair enough.
The opening lines of the series are the first paragraph of the book, almost word for word, but then it's a completely different thing. And there's just like...
inspired nods. By.
Yeah, it's not even really inspired by. It's like appreciative of Shirley Jackson for
the way that a Hallmark movie is inspired by Shakespeare.
Yeah, exactly. It's like we like the title, basically, is what you're saying. So we'll name one of the characters Shirley. But in that opening paragraph, well, and in that book, you get this sense that Hill House is haunted not by any kind of spirit of a person that had died there, but it was created bad. Like there's something insane, as the term that Shirley Jackson uses, just implied and springing out of the actual architecture of the place. Right. I think that's, I think I get that vibe in this story, right? There's something like Prospero has a kind of like, decadence and a hedonism to him. And they describe him as somebody who's just like a weirdo. He's just sort of like into weird things, right? He's like the Russell Brand of his day or something. I don't know. But it's almost like he designed the Abbey in this case. And, yeah. And it's interesting. I kind of that glossed over the fact that it was an Abbey, right? But he sort of repurposed it with insanity in mind. And so the colors, not only are the colors weird and thoughtful, but the angularity of them is weird as well. And so what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it says there's seven chambers, an imperial suite. In many palaces, however, such suites form a long and straight vista, while the folding doors slide back nearly to the walls on either hand so that the view of the whole extent is scarcely impeded. So it's normally, you know, normally they set these chambers up so it's one long hall, like with chamber after chamber after chamber. And it says, here the case was very different, as might be expected from the Duke's love, always a Duke, not a prince, interchangeable terms. From the Duke's love of the bizarre.
Yeah.
They're irregularly imposed, right? So like movement from one to the other is never consistent, it seems like, never the same. And it mentions, I couldn't find it, but it mentions somewhere that he's kind of, people kind of consider him insane too, but you know, kind of a fun insane. He's throwing a party, so he can be as crazy as he wants. We don't really care. But it's unsettling, right? It's an introduction of chaos to what should be orderly. It's interesting because I was doing catechesis yesterday and teaching about how the creation was form and void, formless and void, and God imposes order on the chaos through probably an allegory of the 6 days, mm-hmm. right? Interesting that your church bells are going.
Yeah.
Chapel bell. Can you hear that? That's a bit unsettling as well.
I work in an uncanny place. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But it's almost like he's doing something that is in a way, see that formless and void, that is language of evil, right? That's what evil is darkness. Mm. It's a privation of light, a privation of light, right? So what he's doing here is a kind of satanic thing. He's introducing chaos to what should be orderly. You had an interesting idea about the colors. My mind immediately went to liturgical colors, but that doesn't fit, actually. Because orange and blue are not traditional liturgical colors. So that kind of didn't work. But... there's just this chaos being introduced that is meant, I think, to make you feel weird, like you're in an unreal kind of setting.
Yeah, that's interesting. For a future episode, listener, look for an episode about the Netflix series Midnight Mass by Mike Flanagan, who also did Haunting in Hill House. And I'm asking Carter to join that. And his insight into things like liturgical colors that the priest wears, I definitely want to get into that one with that show.
I have to think about this stuff a lot.
Yeah. So let's bracket that one for an entire different episode. But sure. And that's very interesting, though. Given the fact that there's seven of them, I was sort of thinking of like the passing of time and the fact that a clock, that an ebony clock, a black clock, is a prominent symbol at the beginning and the end of this made me kind of look for motifs of time, basically. And so so I begin, and you know, when I see green kind of in the middle of those seven, that's sort of, you think of that as sort of the summer of life kind of thing, right? Sort of the middle of things. And then things work their way towards orange. You think of the fall, and winter is white. Violet, I'm not really so sure what to do with, but it ends in black, right? And so that,
right.
To me, you have this sort of progression from, you know, the beginnings of things to the ends of things, right? I'm thinking calendar year, but also the days of a week, right? And so,
I'm just trying to connect it to the creation days now, and I'm not sure the other colors work, except for green, maybe, because that's when he creates the land.
Oh, interesting.
In the Genesis account of chapter one of Genesis, but it's definitely if there's any kind of
waters were first
going on.
Waters were first, and blue is the first one.
Light is first.
Oh, light is first. Okay, well, that's second
to last. So it doesn't really work, except that you do have the seventh day is the day of rest and life, right? Like everything's complete, and here it's death.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if there's any connection, it's right there.
Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's great. And yeah, and it's a fascinating kind of open-ended symbol that, you know, Poe, this is one reason Poe gets taught in high school. He just loads his things full of things that English teachers want to see symbolic, symbolic realities in, right?
Make your own symbol.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, insert your own meaning here. Yeah.
Poe is just sort of like, you know, begging for it, right? And so, so with the, when I see the array of colors, that's what I was thinking. But okay, you're onto something.
Sorry, it's also the Black Chamber is also the Western Chamber.
Okay.
The setting sun.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah.
Sunsets in the west, so it's night. It's the end of the day. So yeah, I think your going through a day thing is really onto something.
And nobody wants to go to the black room. There's this sort of like fear of death, right? You know, and so I think that you have definitely Poe working on some kind of symbolic level about the passage of time in some generic way, right? And I'm sure that.
Right.
Some, you know, 10th grader could write a really great paper about each of the colors. I don't feel like doing it right here.
But, orange represents.
I would totally give him props for doing that. But I'm not going to. I think that there's some really interesting literary work, as you would see, like in any kind of allegory going on with that. One, I guess the thing that I want to kind of lead that to is this, the plague, right, is obviously the carrier of death. It's the means by which death happens, right? And he's made this bizarre plague. It's almost like out of a movie script where you die in 30 minutes, right? It's almost like Michael Bay would invent this disease. And so
in a manner that the Nazis die at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes, so
it's totally. It's pretty gruesome.
Totally. Given that it's an allegory, I guess, is what I'm saying, and that it's about death, I think it does lend itself, obviously, to be thinking about COVID, right? And so, I do think that...
It's impossible not to think of that, like... When reading the story now.
Yeah, it really is. And it would almost be irresponsible to not, you know, at least talk about how it might kind of, how the story might apply. Like COVID doesn't apply to the story. The story applies to COVID on some level. Right. And one thing that came to me was the sort of like freedom loving anti-vaxxer, I really do feel like, I know I have to confess, I shouldn't do this publicly, but I don't know how many people listen to the show anyway, so I don't think it really matters. But I think I've had to confess a lot of I resist in myself a lot of kind of bitterness towards folks who are clogging up emergency rooms now because they refuse to get vaccinated. My mother-in-law, my in-laws live with us now, so we can take care of them. And she's had some infection issues, and she's recently lost a toe, and we're lucky it wasn't the whole leg. And so the part of that was exacerbated by emergency room wait times. And I've heard other stories, people literally dying of heart attacks because they couldn't get into the emergency room for all these people who were so brave that they didn't want the vaccine. And so I've had to really resist the utilitarian impulse that I'm having of like saying, well, they're not allowed to use the emergency room if they didn't get vaccinated. Right. And so I'm not a utilitarian.
Right. My wife is a nurse. Like, we've talked about that kind of thing. And she's like, the problem is that for, not the problem, but the reality is for doctors and nurses, they don't have that luxury.
Yeah, exactly.
That you have to help everyone.
Exactly. Right. And so like, and this is why I reject this temptation, right, to go down that road. Right. And so it's been a very big frustration for me, but when I'm reading this, and maybe it's because I'm so frustrated with those folks that, I see Prospero and all of them, right? All of this sort of like, don't show me the possibility of death. How dare you make me afraid, right?
It also says the apartments were densely crowded, and I'm pretty sure masquerade masks don't cover the mouth, so definitely not distancing.
COVID party, properly. Yeah.
Terrible precautions. Sorry,
I had to throw that. So that's one thing that came to mind, and I apologize if it's too personal, but that is one thing that came to mind for me for as I was reading this as a way to kind of think about as an allegory what it refers to, what it kind of shed some kind of wisdom on today, and so this idea of like like flaunting, you know, freedom and life as if death doesn't exist is kind of just distasteful, right? And I think
it's crass.
It's crass. Actually. Yeah, it's worse than distasteful. Yeah, and I think that the Schadenfreude of seeing Prospero get his at the end, like I'm trying to resist that and seeing these poor people who deceived for whatever reason into not getting vaccines dying because of it. Like I there's like a liberal tendency to kind of gloat over those graves, and I refuse to take part of that as well, right? and I think that I don't know, this is giving me a little,
because that is morally problematic. I mean, it's the great commandment, love the Lord your God, but the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself, right? We as much as the stories like this, or revenge stories, especially Poe's revenge stories, as much as they give a sort of catharsis, and we can enjoy that. We're you know, as at least as a Christian, we're morally obligated not to actually feel that way about other people, which, because you know, we're to love our neighbor, to love our enemy, to love everyone as ourselves. So
yeah, it's true. And honestly, living in a particularly, you know, somewhat Trumpy area that I live in.
You and me both, brother.
Yeah. And honestly, that's been very good for me on a kind of moral, ethical level, because you have to come to terms with the fact that, yeah, they might have particular beliefs or voting patterns or something that I find abhorrent, right? But in so many ways, they're wonderful people. Like, you know, there are people who are wonderful people who I can't understand why they think what they think about certain things, right? And so seeing like a fuller picture of people has been really good for me. And so like an allegory reduces everybody to heroes and villains, right? And so Prospero is reduced to somebody who totally deserves it, right? But in real life, you know, it's important to, you know, bring some hospitality, I think, to your interactions with folks who you are really driving you crazy right now.
And you're absolutely right. There is, I think, to go back to something we discussed earlier, I think the class element does it does heighten this a bit. Like when we're talking about folks who are, you know, maybe frustrating us, who are on this sort of anti-vax, et cetera, we're not talking necessarily, there probably is some, but we're not talking necessarily about wealthy people who can seclude themselves off and party while the world dies around them, right? Yeah. We're talking about people who are going to be affected by it, whether they like it or not. And who believe that for whatever reason. In this case, we have someone who knows fully what the situation is and who is choosing to do nothing about it, but seclude himself off. So if Prospero's anyone, it's, again, got to be careful here, but if he's anyone, he's like a politician who knows better, but is feeding into the fears of his constituents because he knows it'll get him, you know, into office again later, he or her. That's what I like am kind of seeing here, right? It's more the irony is sharpened because it's someone whose privilege allows them to do a certain thing.
Yes. And I'm going to go back to the original lockdown, like the first wave of lockdowns, right?
Yeah.
There was, I mean, like largely liberal sentiment that, you know, oh, no one should go to work anymore. Everyone should just work remotely. Well, not everybody is a lawyer or, you know, an HR executive. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I'm a carpenter.
Yeah. Not everybody.
I can't do that by distance.
Yes.
I'm a carpenter as well as being a priest. So.
And as a teacher, I can do it for a particular amount of time, but it's hugely taxing, right? And so not everybody can do this, right? And so
I taught virtually for 3 years.
Yes.
It's a different way of doing things, and it has its own sort of fatigue, especially for someone who's not used to it.
Yeah. And a great thing about an allegory, when an allegory works, it's not just picking on one segment of society, right? And there are ways to apply Prospero's lesson across our society, right? And I think
there
are many, just as many, maybe not just as many, but there are many lessons for liberals as well as conservatives, as well as upper class, as well as lower class by reading the story.
I mean, we equal opportunity. Like we just hit the conservatives, but we're talking about self-righteous liberals a little bit ago.
So. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely, right? Yeah, and so that's one thing. I want to move to the movie version. I know we're supposed to just kind of focus on the literature here, but I know that you haven't seen it. So I just want to kind of like the Roger Corman version of this is a legitimately brilliant film. It's very psychedelic. It's very kind of dreamlike in a lot of ways. They do something somewhat different with the rooms. The rooms are multicolored. I didn't gauge whether they were the exact same colors, but there are like a line of rooms. And so people walk from one straight through another and into all these colors. And it has this kind of like, destabilizing effect on your environment. So they do somewhat different things with the story, but mostly they kind of invent an actual plot because there's no real plot to the story.
Which is the case in many posters. Yeah,
exactly. Really, so. Yeah. And the plot is that Vincent Price, who's like at the height of his powers, he's just incredible in this role. He plays Prospero and the movie opens with basically this red cloaked figure who approaches an old woman in the woods and has a white rose that he does a magic thing to, and it turns red, and he gives it to her and says, "Take it to your village. Your liberation is at hand," or something like that. And so she's this sort of like prophetic voice, and she dies of the Red Death, right? And so basically he's brought the Red Death.
Rude.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He's sending the Red Death into the village of poor people, right? But with the message that they are going to be liberated. I forget the actual term. It wasn't liberated. But,
so is this that their death will be a release, kind of?
It works both ways, because through that, Prospero comes into the village and harasses people and is going to put a couple people to death for various reasons. Through that, he gets the idea to have the party because he sees the Red Death is in the village, but it basically starts in the motion of the events that destroy the aristocracy completely. Right. They're all contained in this castle.
Interesting.
While most of the proletariat,
sounds like a communist allegory. It
very much
the Red Death.
Yes. It very much has this kind of like lefty kind of approach to it, which is very interesting from Roger Corman. And, but ultimately, like there are like six, I think, survivors from the village. And the Red Death basically says, "I didn't infect them with them." At the end of the movie, all these other figures of death who match the various colors on the list here, they all kind of meet together in the woods and talk about what work they did that day.
The blue death and the white death.
Yeah, yeah. There are all these different like cloaked figures that come together and talk about their day at the office, kind of, you know. And
gather around the water cooler.
Yeah. But the Red Death basically suggests that he didn't kill the young heroine of the movie, who Prospero is trying to initiate into his decadent lifestyle of Satanism, in this case,
right.
Her boyfriend, a couple of other villagers, and this little girl, right? And so there's definitely a weird class thing, although the working class doesn't get off free. Like, they're essentially wiped out as well.
Right.
But so it plays up the class thing that you noticed on that level, okay? But it also introduces this idea that Prospero is a Satan worshiper.
Right.
And that he is seeking kind of protection by Satan, and he's all proud of himself for bringing him all these sacrifices, and he thinks that should get him off. And Death basically says, "I don't work for Satan." Like, Death basically says, "I'm an independent contractor, right?"
I'm in a different department. Yeah,
and my boss. He makes a very interesting religious,
like,
theological claim at one point where he says, every person chooses their own God, whether it's God or Satan or whatever, and by their actions. Their actions create their God, right? And that is theologically dense and probably deserves its own show. But
it sounds like the Exodus is what it sounds like. The Red Death is like the Angel of Death.
Mm-hmm.
Prospero represents Pharaoh, and the liberation of the people who are being oppressed by Pharaoh is is that, I mean, some of them still die. In this case, the analogy falls apart in the fact that some of the poor still die. But they're liberated because the powerful are destroyed. So it just rung very Exodus light.
This is why I raised it to you, because I wanted your insight into this, and I had not thought of that, but I think it actually works. There is a kind of remnant left of this, of these oppressed people that you think.
I mean, in blood always brings these ideas of sacrifice and atonement to the fore anyway, right?
Yeah, and it totally plays up. Now, the Red Death doesn't come up with a mask. He shows up as this red cloak thing. And basically, when they take his mask off, which is just like this frilled little leather covering, Vincent Price sees his own face there. And so as dead from the Red Death, right? And then he dies of the Red Death, right? And so in a normal way. It's a really interesting plot that they've attached to this, though. And I wanted to tell you, because I was looking for an insight like that about the Exodus. That's a really interesting religious element to it. And the fact that this was an abbey converted into a satanic temple is also sort of like, I think the movie does something interesting with what Prospero does to the abbey here in the story version.
It makes explicit what seems to be implicit in the story itself. Like I was saying, like in the story, the chambers are all wonky intentionally. So it's a mockery of natural things. It's an abbey made into a castle, right? A place that's supposed to be of peace made into a place of wealth and defense and war. It's the chambers aren't like normal chambers. They're all wonky and not straight. So that what's normally orderly is disorderly and chaotic, formless and void, if you will. And instead of a place of memento mori, a place of spiritual growth and holiness, it's a place of just decadent Epicurean revelry. So he's taking, I mean, all the imagery is Prospero taking this and reversing it and making it the exact opposite of what it's supposed to be by nature. He's taking something by nature and he's making it counter to nature. So I again go to this this idea of like the privation notion of evil. Evil is not a thing itself. It's the distortion, corruption, or absence of a thing.
Yeah.
It's the absence of light. It's the absence of life. It's the absence of order. It's the absence of whatever.
It doesn't have substance in and of itself.
Right. It's not substantive in and of itself. It's a twisting and distortion of a good thing.
Yeah.
So it's all good stuff that he's just corrupting and making evil.
I'm giving you an assignment to watch this movie because there's so much of that.
Yeah, I want to. I got him now.
Prospero, goes out of his way to, he finds an innocent girl from the village, and basically his whole goal is to corrupt her into his life. That's sort of what he's trying to do, right? Is to corrupt the innocent, and that's kind of what he has seen himself doing with his own class. He's corrupted them into becoming these decadent beings. At one point, he says, "You're dumb like a donkey. You should pretend to be a donkey," and they pretend to be a donkey. "You're insignificant like a worm, you should pretend to be a worm," and they do it for him. And he corrupts them in that way. And
he's like
another
apostle of he's like an apostle of the devil.
Exactly, right? And the fact that the Red Death in this movie is just a red cloaked figure, and he's got like red skin, but you can barely see. He's very covered up. But he Prospero's instructions for the mask for the ball is no one's allowed to wear red, because we don't want to be reminded. That's their version of this, right? But red being the redemptive blood, right, that we so often associate with some Christian practices. I know that I've opened up a can of worms about substitutional penal atonement.
The life is in the blood, though.
Yes,
we all know that, right?
Yes, yeah, that's exactly that's, right. Right. I know. That's a major red. I would get red flags on Twitter from some people, right? But just that is a thing we associate with Christian practice is blood yeah. as associated with redemption for whatever reason, right? And so, and he wants that out of his house. He takes the cross off of the young girl when she shows up. And so anyway, I just wanted to kind of introduce that movie as a really interesting interpretation of this allegory. And it really does do really interesting things with the main threads, I think, that we saw in our reading. So, Carr, did you have any final thoughts on this really interesting story?
Ooh. You know, I don't think so. I mean, we hit a lot of really interesting stuff, and I do think it's I feel like there's more that could be said about the people who are involved in the partying, the people who are there. I mean, they're there of their own free will, but then once they're there, they can't leave. It's, it's like a Hotel California, right? you can check in, but you never leave. But it's in, I haven't really thought about this much, but just the fact that there is a sort of complicity that they have in this too. They're not the instigators. They're not the big bad evil. But they're going along with it. And none of them is standing up and saying, what the heck is, why are we doing this, right? They're just, they're either cowards or willfully complicit. So either way, it's either a sin of commission or a sin of omission. But either way, they're, they are complicit in one way or another. It's also interesting, we didn't talk about the ebony clock really, but the clock has I noticed that every time the clock chimes, everybody stops what they're doing, including the musicians. And like, it says that they sort of like everyone gets nervous every time the clock chimes. And then they'll start after it's done, they'll finally sort of build back up into partying again. So it's this like there's this consistent reminder that death is coming. And they sort of chuckle half-heartedly and like try to ignore it and then go back to what they're doing. And that whole vibe felt very much, I know this is a whole other tangent, but it got me into thinking about consumer culture and how, and streaming and social media and how, well, okay. So there's this favorite line I have from Blaise Pascal where, paraphrased, he essentially says the hardest thing in the world is to sit quietly in your room, which to introverts makes no sense. Yeah. They're like, what else would I want to do? But the point that Pascal is making is that when you do that, you have to look at yourself.
Yeah.
When you sit quietly in your room, undistracted, you have to look and see who you really are. And you have to consider things like the reality of death.
Yeah.
They're doing everything they can to distract themselves from that. But occasionally, with the chime of the clock, occasionally reality punches through and they're faced with it just for a moment. And then they're able to start distracting themselves again. And to me, that is so descriptive of our cultural moment where we don't want to face serious things we don't want to deal with them. We don't want to try and fix them. We don't want to have to like work on making the world a better place. We don't want to face the reality of our death and the memento mori that we need to live the right way now because death is coming eventually, yeah. unexpectedly. And it's going to punch through now and then. It's going to come in front of us now and then, but then we turn the TV on and or you know, listen to a podcast or do whatever we can to forget that we just had that moment of stark reality. So anyway, that was my sort of final, I guess, thought on how to take the allegory here.
And it's just one more way, Carter, that you gave us to think about how this story really works as a really good allegory, because it's you can place it over so many things and even the modern world 170 years after Poe wrote it, and so yeah, it's an amazing little work of art, and I was really happy to talk with you about it today. Thank you for your time. Those of you listening, thank Carter Stepper for me as well. I would like you to go ahead and take a listen to the other shows in the network's Halloween crossover. crossover this year. It should be a lot of fun to hear what everybody else had to say about those other Poe stories, and to see if those are just as relevant to our world as Mask of the Red Death is to us in COVID times. So for Carter Stepper, my name is Danny Anderson, thanking you for listening to another episode of the Sectarian Review Podcast.